Although the mind and body are often viewed as being separate, studies show mental and physical health are actually closely related. Good mental health can positively affect your physical health. And in return, poor mental health can negatively affect your physical health. Today on the West Side, we'll learn more about how this connection is being studied to help kids with adversity learn resilience. Youth mental health is our topic today. Good morning, I'm glad you're here. I'm Claire Neipert. Coming up a bit later in the program, we'll be talking about COVID-19's continued impact on children's mental health and what youth-serving people and organizations are doing to help. For the next several minutes, though, we're talking about how adverse experiences impact children's mental well-being with Families and Relationships Program Outreach Manager Brooke Berg from UW-Madison Extension. If you have questions for our guest, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-228-5615, and our email address is ideas@wpr.org. Mental Health Matters is a project with over 20 partnering organizations in Chippewa and Eau Claire counties that aims to improve mental well-being for middle school and high school youth. One of their goals is to raise education and awareness through a workshop that explains how childhood trauma can impact physical and mental health of kids and teens. Here to talk with us about Mental Health Matters ACE Resilience Workshop is Brooke Berg. She helped create the workshop's curriculum and taught it around the Chippewa Valley. Welcome to the West Side, Brooke.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with defining a term important to the workshop. Brooke, what are ACEs, or Adverse Childhood Experiences?
Sure. So you will hear those terms interchangeably a lot. And really, when we talk about ACEs or adverse childhood experiences, we are talking about negative life events that occur during childhood. These are things that interfere with healthy child development and can lead to negative health outcomes in adulthood. And sometimes ACEs are also referred to as toxic stress or childhood trauma. So you'll hear varying terms when we're talking about that adversity.
What is an example of an adverse childhood experience?
Sure. So there was a study done, and I can talk a little bit about the original study that was done. But when we talk about adversity or that toxic stress, we're talking about significant, I would say, dysfunctions in a child's life, such as abuse, neglect, having a parent who has been incarcerated, having a parent who has experienced domestic abuse in front of that child. So those are some of the examples of adversity that we're talking about in this ACE study.
Mm. And can you talk more about that ACE study and when that started and how it informs what we do today?
Sure. It's really interesting. People say it's like this study that is like the best kept secret, and it's thankfully not a secret anymore, but it was in the late 80s that Dr. Vincent Folletti, who was a director of a weight loss program, made a really unexpected clinical observation, and he discovered that child sexual abuse and or physical abuse was really common in his patients in this weight loss program, and that the abuse typically preceded the onset of that obesity. And so he concluded that obesity was not necessarily the real problem, and that many participants had used that as a solution for coping with those problems that they couldn't or didn't want to talk about. And so this Dr. Folletti teamed up with Dr. Robert Anda at the CDC to really further explore this connection. And that led to a partnership that ultimately became what we know now as the ACE study. This study was originally done with more than 17,000 middle-class, college-educated, majority white. Most of the people had health insurance. They participated in this study, and they found that 64% of those participants had experienced at least one of these 10 types of childhood adversity that they measured, and that more than one in five people had reported having more than three of these ACEs. And again, when we say ACEs, we're talking about abuse, neglect, incarcerated parents, divorce, violence. So there were 10 things that they did in this original study. And since then, Wisconsin has replicated this study specific to our residents here. And the most recent data shows that in Wisconsin, 59% of our residents have one or more ACEs, and 16% of our population actually has four or more of these ACEs. So really high levels of ACEs that could potentially cause some pretty serious health outcomes as an adult.
Mm. If we faced adversity as a child, does that necessarily mean we will repeat our trauma as adults?
No, not necessarily. So when we are trying to understand this adversity, and when we think about some of the really tough things that kids have had to face, one of the things that's important to think about is just understanding how that adversity affects brain development, and then what we can do to help rebuild what we call protective factors. So I guess I can explain a little bit. So early in life, when you think about our young kiddos, their brain is going through rapid growth, and these neural connections are being made. And what we know about brain development is that whatever is experienced, whether it's positive or negative, early in life gets developed as those neural pathways are created. So those pathways, if you've got negative experiences happening over and over in a child's life, those pathways are created stronger and stronger. Same thing if you have positive interactions. And so what we know is that if something like an adverse experience, maybe it's extreme poverty, maybe it's living with family members who have substance abuse issues, but if something threatens a child every single day, that emergency response system in their brain is activated over and over again. And that child is sort of always in that fight or flight mode. And then that prefrontal cortex, which is where we do some of the academic pieces of our work, becomes stunted. So essentially, children with toxic stress live much of their lives in this fight, flight, or freeze mode, and potentially respond to the world as a place of constant danger. And when their brains are really overloaded with these stress hormones, they're unable to function appropriately. And then we see things like they can't focus on learning or challenging behaviors. We see that they maybe don't develop healthy relationships with peers because of many reasons, one of those being, you know, unable to trust adults too. So it is something that definitely impacts a child's development. Does it mean that it's their destiny and that they are going to remain in that fight, flight, or freeze mode forever? Definitely not. You know, one of the things we like to talk with people about is that you can understand your ACE score and take a look at that quiz and find out where you are, but that is not your destiny, and that there are also so many protective factors and wonderful things that can mitigate what has happened in a child's life.
So I'm hearing you say that, you know, we can't take away the trauma that a child's experienced, but what can an educator, a parent, or a caregiver do to help a kid that who has already faced adversity kind of cope with what they've experienced?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So that is why this Mental Health Matters group really focused on helping people understand what ACEs are, understand what that can potentially do to brain development, but then what is our role? What can we do to really help build resilience in the children that we work with and that we are around every day? So resilience has a lot of different definitions, but it really is the ability to bounce back from adversity, or sometimes we say it's that process of managing stress and functioning well, even when you're faced with challenges and adversity and trauma. And when we look at that, and when we work with educators, social workers, youth group counselors, we really are talking to them about helping build resilience in kids, and that includes looking at the protective factors. It includes things like, first and foremost, caring relationships. If a child has someone that they can count on, that loves them, that is there for them, whether that is a coach or a cousin or a friend or a relative, that is huge in helping build that resilience. So even when a child has faced adversity, if they know that they've got someone in their corner, that really helps build their resilience. There are a lot of other pieces to resilience as well, helping them feel like they are participating meaningful participation in things and having mastery over something. So when we talk to youth serving professionals, we oftentimes say, find out what the child is interested in and help them become really good at that so that they can master whatever that is, if that's music or sports or karate or art, helping them really build that positive self-esteem. We also talk a little bit about cultural identity and having a good understanding and acceptance of who they are. So when we think about resiliency and helping these children, we really want to focus on how we can promote the strengths of the youth and amplify what is already good. So essentially, our role as a youth serving professional, as a caring adult, is to explore and identify the strengths of these children and help them become more aware of their own abilities. And that essentially really helps build their resilience so that they can bounce back from any adversity that they may have faced or will face in the future.
Mental Health Matters ACE Resilience Workshop has taught almost 2,000 educators, government workers, and healthcare providers around the Chippewa Valley. Brooke, I'm wondering, what do you hear from people who've attended your workshops?
It's been really fun to be out in the community and talking with people about this work. So one of our strategies when this group was created was to look at youth serving organizations so that not only individuals could increase their awareness and their knowledge, but that organizations could learn together and potentially make system-wide changes to the work that they do, to their approach to people in general, in sort of this more healing-centered approach. And so it's been really great to hear. Like you mentioned, we've served over 90 agencies and almost 2,000 individuals over the last several years doing this curriculum. And we've heard a lot of positive comments. One of the comments from one of our organizations said that our staff absolutely felt it was one of the best presentations they have ever had the opportunity to be a part of. Another one said, I really think more people should complete this training because many people have childhood ACEs they might not even realize or know about, and this is beneficial information to learn about. So it's been great to help people. There's been a lot of aha moments for specifically teachers, counselors, social workers that we've worked with over the years, and realizing that some of these behaviors that they are witnessing in children have, you know, there's that reason they better understand those kids now. So it's been great. We've been able to reach a lot of organizations, a lot of individuals, and make a pretty big difference in our community.
Finally, I want to ask, how can someone, an individual or an organization, sign up to attend one of the ACE Resilience workshops?
Sure. So we do have, typically we are offering these to, like I mentioned, organizations or groups where you can work together to help change some of the policies and procedures in your own organization. So if your group is interested, you can always check out our website, which is cvmentalhealthmatters.org. You can also look up Eau Claire Healthy Communities. So our group is based out of the Chippewa Valley and the health departments. And so you can always reach out there to request that one of our trainers come out and do a presentation either in person or virtually.
Thank you so much for joining us, Brooke. Brooke is the Outreach Program Manager of Family Engagement and Relationships at the UW-Madison Division of Extension. Up next, we'll hear from Elk Mound Middle School Counselor Cindy Borgette and Linda Hall, Director of Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health. What are your questions about mental health in schools? Maybe you're a parent. How do you talk with your kids about mental health? You can call us at 715-471-6490. That's 715-471-6490. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Clara Neipert, and this is the West Side on the Ideas Network. The Larry Mueller Show comes up at 11. Your shrubs and trees, especially those that are newly planted, need different care in colder months. Larry talks about what to do before the ground freezes, how to protect them from fluctuating temperatures, and when it's safe to prune. The Larry Mueller Show is up next on this station. Coming up next week on the West Side, we're talking about parole and probation reform. Wisconsin has the highest rate of parole supervision among its neighboring states, and the lengths of parole are nearly twice the national average. We'll hear from local activists and correctional supervisors about how they're taking a second look at these systems. That's next Friday at 10 on this station. Mental health was one of the top three priorities identified as needing improvement in both Chippewa and Eau Claire counties in the 2014 to 2015 community health assessments. And the need for discussion is there. According to the Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey, 47% of surveyed high school students in Chippewa County experienced problems with anxiety in 2019. Joining us for the rest of the show to talk about youth mental health is Cindy Borgette, a counselor at Elk Mound School District. Welcome to the West Side, Cindy.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Linda Hall. Linda's the director of Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health. Good morning, Linda.
Hi, Clara. Thanks for having me.
As always, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 715-471-6490. And our email address is ideas@wpr.org. Well, every year, the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health puts together an annual report. Linda, what did 2020's report tell us? What do we know, generally, about kids' mental health in our state?
Well, you're right. We do an annual report. It's a critical piece of our agenda. Than our charge, which is to monitor the status of children's mental health and also to work with others around the state and with other state agencies to improve children's access to mental health treatment that they might need. What we've been seeing for children in terms of the data is that they are really losing their ability to make and retain relationships. And that's a trend that's actually unfortunately growing. We're also seeing that there are high levels of anxiety and depression, and that the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which you mentioned earlier, has shown that for several years, the number of children feeling sad or hopeless almost every day has been increasing. We also know that Wisconsin has a higher than national average teen suicide rate. And we know that that has a lot to do with belonging and having supportive relationships. So a little bit about, some of it coming out of those ACEs that Brooke was talking about, but also other factors that are happening. Of course, in 2020, the pandemic had an impact on kind of watching the data but these figures that I've just given you were really true before the pandemic, and we think that they will continue afterwards. So they're real points of concern and are helping us to decide what we need to do with our network of 150 plus stakeholders in the mental health system to improve children's mental health. And I'd be happy to talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, we'll certainly touch on the pandemic and how we can build social connections for kids a bit later in the show. But first, Cindy, I want to talk with you about your podcast. You host a podcast called The Counselors with Bobby Phillips, who is Elk Mound's elementary school counselor, and you've covered issues like positivity and gratitude. I'm wondering, what inspired you to start the podcast?
We have a lot of fun with our podcast, mainly because parents were coming to us with questions surrounding what Linda was talking about. This has been a trend where students are struggling to feel connectedness, senses of belonging, and really be able to draw on that resiliency that they have within them to succeed in school, but in life in general. So we use our podcast as a way to help parents in 10 minutes or less is our goal to come away with some takeaways on things that they can try in their house, stuff that they can try at home that if it works, great, keep it. If not, let's move on and try something else that we've suggested. Our goal is to really do that once a month along with our Mounder Minute, which is a little video that we highlight these skills as well, but also ask the kids in our school how those things work with them. And if they're finding them successful as well.
As you mentioned, you do give a lot of advice to parents. So I'm wondering, how important is a student's home life when it comes to their mental health?
A student's home life is very important. If you think about it, they spend half their time with us when they are school aged, but they also spend the rest of that time at home. So parents are a key piece in the mental health puzzle. Sometimes when I'm working with parents, they feel a little bit out of control with that. And I want to remind them that they are really in the driver's seat here, and we are here to help them. And we are so proud of our community members because they are seeing needs within their children, and they are reaching out for skills, and they are reaching out for ways and solutions to help their children. So with parents at home, knowing that you don't have to be perfect in how you're supporting your child with mental health, because we all have mental health, right? But being able to acknowledge that maybe there is a struggle going on, or even acknowledging the successes, is very powerful too. And being able to stop and deliberately do that can not only help your child, but it can help yourself as well.
So Clara, you know, just following up on what Cindy said there, you know, we talked about the levels of anxiety that kids are experiencing. We know that that increased during the pandemic because of the stress that their parents are under. And just as Cindy said, if parents can just recognize that this is kind of a fact of life right now, we all need to cope with it, that's really important. If they can make space to listen to their kids, what their concerns are, just listen, that's really important. And I had the chance to listen to one of Cindy's podcasts. It was great. And I just wanted to say that during the pandemic, we also turned, kind of shifted focus a little bit and put out some tools for parents to use. Probably the one that we've gotten the best reaction to is our feelings thermometer, which is available on our website, which is children.wi.gov. And it's a little thing that you can print and put up on your refrigerator that just reminds you to think about the feelings you're having during the day and talk about them. And if you're in kind of a bad mood, it gives you some ideas about how you can shift to a better mood. And the data research shows us that even just thinking about that shift will make a difference in how you feel.
We're talking about youth mental health today on the West Side. You can call us at 715-471-6490 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I want to continue our conversation about the pandemic. Research says that the pandemic created added challenges for kids and adults who were already struggling with their mental health. A study of insurance claims found that Wisconsin is one of the top five states for having the most insurance claims submitted for intentional self-harm injuries during the pandemic. Cindy, I'm wondering, as a school counselor, how did you see kids react to the pandemic in your school district?
I would say that the anxiety that was already there before COVID-19 did increase. And I would say that's a common phenomenon across the state, as you pointed out with some of your statistics there. And knowing that, There has been some positive side effects from COVID-19. I don't want to force us into a silver lining, but now that we are in a place where all of us are experiencing some trauma and some struggle surrounding our mental health, we have noticed that our community members across the county and across the state are really more open to talking about strategies for mental health and talking about resiliency as being a real issue and being open and wanting to help their children surrounding that. So with that, COVID-19 within our school to be able to support our students. We received a mental health grant here that allowed us to hire a mental health coordinator that is helping us to come up with some consistent processes across the district to be able to support all of our students as they're moving towards their mental health wellness journey. And things like that have included providing consistent curriculum within the classroom surrounding coping skills, identifying their emotions, much like Linda was talking about with that thermometer, just by being able to acknowledge that you're having an emotion and that emotions are okay, help you feel better. And we've also worked very, very hard to partner with some of our resources outside of the school to provide support to our students who need that extra help.
You and your co-host, Bobby, mentioned that kids are being pretty positive, actually, about the changes in their worlds in one of your podcast episodes. Talk about that more. How are you proud of the way that kids in your district responded to adversity?
Mm-hmm. So our students have that intrinsic inner resilience. I would say that it's still there. We have drawn on it a lot. So we need to find ways as the adults in their lives, the important people in their lives, to be able to put that resilience back. It's kind of like bucket filling activities, right? And help them know that that resilience is still there, even though we're having to use it over and over again. And Bobby and I, and then Hugh Goodrich is also our high school counselor, have come up with some ways for parents to do that are really pretty easy to implement in their home. One of them we call boundaries with grace, right? When students are working to develop resiliency, they need structure to do that within, right? To know that if they make a mistake, they are not their mistake, and we're going to help them learn through that, and they have strengths within their resiliency to help with that. But the with grace part is something that we're putting a lot of focus on, right? Because when we are struggling with our own mental health and our own stresses, sometimes when our children make a mistake, we struggle with the grace piece. So to be able to respond to our students within our boundaries in a way that is kind and respond to ourselves in a way that is kind with the way we talk to ourselves and the way we talk to our children can be a really simple fix. And a boundary that we tend to start with is 5 to 10 minutes each night of screen-free time that's quiet and you talk about your day. And that way they're able to process their emotions. And now that Linda has brought up that resource, I would certainly suggest using the thermometer as a talking piece within that 10 minutes of quiet time in a day to respond to each other with grace and acknowledgement.
Cindy, you kind of touched on this, but I see you're saying that kids are really responding to the pandemic in very resilient ways. But as an adult, I feel like I'm having trouble sometimes. So what advice do you have for parents to cope with the pandemic?
The advice that I automatically go to is be transparent with your struggles. So what I mean by that is, keep in mind that it needs to be age appropriate, right? You don't need to be talking with your children about everything that's happening, but to be transparent with your kids and acknowledge that you are struggling. The way I do it with my own children and then the children here at the middle school, I'll basically think out loud. I'll say things like, man, I am having a hard day today. Things did just not go the way that I needed them to go, and I'm frustrated with that. I'm going to take a moment to calm myself down before I answer your question. So just thinking out loud and sharing with them that you are struggling too can not only help them know where you're at. So a lot of times our children will internalize the way that we respond as us being frustrated with them. And if we're thinking out loud, they can know exactly where we're at, but we're also modeling healthy ways to process big emotion. So it's got a double-sided benefit, right? Our children know where we are at. they are learning the benefit of processing emotions in a healthy way, but we're also able to share with them what's going on in our heads and what's going on with us, which is healing in and of itself.
Linda, when the pandemic struck, the Office of Children's Mental Health asked professionals and people on the ground how the pandemic impacted their lives. So I'm wondering, what did you hear from these partners?
Well, we heard that it was stressful for them, but we also asked mental health professionals how it was changing their practice. And a lot of folks shifted very quickly to online therapy. So kids came to them online instead of in person. And there were a lot of positives around that. There are many kids, because they're so used to screens, actually could interact better, by doing their therapy online. It's also true that some kids don't work well with that. And so, alternative things have to be found. And now that things have opened up a little bit, some in-person visits have returned. We also found that a lot of the paperwork stuff and prior authorizations that were delaying kids getting treatment were taken care of. The state Department of Health Services and the Badger Care program did some really fast footwork and removed a lot of these barriers. So actually, I think that we're going to see that more kids got therapy over this period of time. And that's really been helpful.
This year, many school districts are offering in-person instruction. Linda, what challenges might kids face as they transition back into in-person learning?
Well, I think, there's some hesitation about being back in the classroom with lots of other kids. I mean, I know among adult friends that people are a little uneasy about being in a large group. And so for some kids, that's the case. I really like to encourage people, and maybe Cindy can speak more to this, to just kind of accept kids where they're at, because we know that some kids are going to be delighted to be back in school. They're going to like the extra attention that they get from teachers and other school staff. They're going to feel safer than they actually felt at home. And then other kids, it's going to be more of a transition, and they're going to need a little more tenderness until they can start to relax into the new situation. And then, of course, there's still the issue that, COVID is out there, and school is being interrupted by quarantines almost daily, it seems like. So there's a lot of adjustment. I had the opportunity to listen to an expert on how to work with people after a trauma. And he really emphasized that we need to just open our arms and be open to whatever it is people bring to us, and acknowledge that people are going to be at different places, and to acknowledge that we need to take care of ourselves too.
Cindy, I want to ask you the same question. What are you seeing as kids transition back and forth from going virtual to in-person and quarantining? What are you seeing at Elk Mound?
I would echo a lot of what Linda was saying. We have students who are at a lot of different varying levels. Not only do we all approach life with different resiliency levels, we all approach life with different worries and different tolerance level for that worry. And what I would say is, while academics is coming along, what we are really seeing a need to focus on is the ability for us to help our students deal with the fact that the world right now is big, right? There's a lot of big emotions that are happening, and helping our staff know how to respond to in the moment to a student where they're at, just like Linda said. So we have been focusing a lot on helping our staff have the skills and the tools to be able to welcome that student with open arms, and be able to help that student sit within the uncomfortable with the knowledge that we're not able to fix everything, but helping them sit within the uncomfortable, build their resilience, and really make school a safe place to be and make teachers some of those adults that are important and safe in their lives.
We're talking about...
Claire, if I could just...
Go ahead.
I could just add on to what Cindy is saying. We at our office are looking very closely at what makes a difference for kids and their ability to develop life skills. I talked earlier about kids losing their ability to make relationships. We know that in order to build those life skills, they need to feel secure. And I think that what Cindy is saying is so important, that we need to, if we deal with those feelings and help kids to feel connected and feel more secure, the academic training, the academic and the school's classes will fall into place. Mm. Right now, we really need to focus on what's happening emotionally for kids and their families.
We're talking about how the pandemic impacted kids' mental health today on the West Side. We're joined by Linda Hall, Director of Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health, and Cindy Bourget. What strategies do you use to talk with your children about their mental health? Are you having a hard time finding your child a psychiatrist or therapist in the area? There's still time for you to join our conversation. Call 715-471-6490 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Claire Neipert. This is The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Spectrum West is back this week at 10 a.m. Thursday. Al Ross shares interviews highlighting the best and most interesting in the world of arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin. That's the focus of Spectrum West, Thursday at 10 on this station. On Thursday, October 14th at noon, join WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden and WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson for a free virtual conversation about WPR's new podcast called Mapped Out. Secret meetings, deleted documents, and a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Wisconsin's 2011 legislative redistricting process was anything but routine. Join the creators of Mapped Out for a behind-the-scenes look at the reporting that went into this six-part investigative series that debuted earlier this week. You can submit your questions, too. Register online at wpr.org/presents. Well, today we're talking about kids' mental health. The Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health reports that 66 of the 72 counties in the state have a psychiatrist shortage. For example, as of 2019, Pepin County had a ratio of more than 7,000 individuals for every one mental health provider. Linda, tell me more about this mental health provider shortage. What can we do to address this problem?
Well, the shortage of mental health providers, not only psychiatrists, but therapists, is real. It's true across the country, not just in Wisconsin. And we see that this isn't likely to change in the near future because there are fewer people going into the field than there were before. But what we do know is that there are many things that we can do to help address children's mental health. We know there are lots of good things happening at school, the school mental health programs. I mean, you're hearing from Cindy and what her colleagues are doing at the Elk Mound schools. We are seeing mental health therapists coming into schools and helping kids that way. And there are growing numbers of schools that are doing that. And The collaboration grants that Cindy was talking about earlier is one of the ways that from the state level, we're supporting the growth of these mental health access points at school. We're also seeing an increase in terms of peer-led organizations. So many schools have programs like Sources of Strength or Hope Squad, where primarily high school kids are leading conversations at school about mental health. And so we know that even, under the current data shows that that kids have symptoms of mental illness for years before they actually get treatment. So it's really important for us to open up these conversations, reduce the stigma, increase access at school, and really get kids involved in conversations earlier. And I think we can head off a lot of longer lasting mental illness, because we do know that if you have a serious mental illness throughout your childhood and it doesn't get addressed, that you have more likelihood that that's going to stay with you as an adult. So those are some of the strategies, school mental health. I would say the other thing is that we're doing a lot more in terms of people with lived experience being peer supports for kids and for their parents, some of the problems that are in their way.
You mentioned that there's a shortage of people actually going into the professions of mental health providers. What could we do to encourage more people, Linda, to go into mental health care?
Well, I have to say that I think that I'm afraid I'm getting a little bit of an echo here. I hope it's not at your end. I have to say that salary levels and the reimbursement levels for those in the mental health field are a barrier to people choosing this. And then there is still stigma in some communities, so that creates another barrier. We at the state level, our office and other folks who are advocates for improving the mental health system have been trying to address this. One thing that has happened recently, one positive point, is that the Department of Health Services now is giving out grants to organizations that have trainees to help them support those trainees so that they have some financial, they have support in supervising them and the cost for people to get to licensing. So it's a complex problem. I think it's kind of similar to what we see happening with educators, that we are not seeing as many go into the field as we need to replace the people who are leaving.
Cindy, how do mental health services in rural areas and towns like Elk Mound compare to services found in larger towns and cities?
I would say we are also struggling to get enough providers to support the need that we have in the schools. While we do have a system and we do work with outside therapists that come in and help our students and provide therapy and counseling services within the school, we are facing 6 to 8 week waiting times. We are facing barriers surrounding access for them to be actually able to be able to come into the school, and how to provide telehealth to younger students, that type of thing. Because when we do open up our area and offer it to therapists and counseling services that extend an hour to 2 hours away, our option really is to do telehealth. And while that works for older children, we really struggle with that with our younger kiddos. So when we compare it to larger areas of the state, again, it's the ability to access resources that are sparse. It's not that our community resources aren't doing their best to help. It's just our need is growing bigger than what we have access to.
What's the difference between a school counselor and a therapist? How much support can you as a school counselor provide?
Great question. So there are some differences between a school counselor and a therapist. As a school counselor, I have a caseload of about 300 to 350 students. So keeping that in mind, my role is to really help to build the generalized resiliency skills. So what I mean by that is, how do you get organized? How do you handle conflict? How do you identify that you're anxious? What are some coping skills that you can use? And then when I notice students who are struggling with those things, I'll work with them a little bit more intently. But when we get to the point where I can see that they have a larger need, that's when we will transition them out to a therapist who can work with them more consistently and more intently one-on-one.
The Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health gathered data that showed 11% of Black children needed but did not receive mental health treatment in 2018, as compared to just 2% of white children. Additionally, 78% of LGBTQ teens reported having significant anxiety, and 42% considered suicide in 2019. These statistics hint at larger and more complex issues. Linda, why do some youth in Wisconsin seem to have such a different experience than others?
Unfortunately, when we disaggregate the information about children's mental health, we uncover these kinds of things that African-American kids are not getting as much access to treatment as others, and the LGBTQ plus kids also are not getting access. So it's, you know, partly an issue of fewer of people from those cultures being already in the field of mental health and being therapists in the field. We are working with our teams. We have a trauma-informed care team that is producing webinars to help people who are in the field be more culturally aware of the issues that come up for these kids and be more sensitive to them. So, you know, we talked already about the shortage of mental health professionals. While we're waiting for that number to change, we're also trying to work with folks to that are in the field to be sensitive and more open to some of the issues that these kids bring. But there are challenges. The mental health shortage, mental health professional shortage, is true everywhere in the state. It's true in urban areas as well as in the rural areas. So that's why we keep looking at additional ways to help kids feel better and to address the initial stages of mental health conditions that they might have.
I would echo Linda there that it's also a good reminder that our community support and our community involvement in our kids' lives is so vital, especially now when we don't have the access that we would want to outside counseling services. There are ways that we are working to fill that need, and we rely heavily on our community support. So as parents, but also as youth organizations, our religious organizations in town, our police department has done a lot of work to help us support our students within our mental health needs too. So as we start to get creative with it, we do rely on our parents as well to kind of give us some ideas to look outside of our traditional support systems.
Linda, with the last couple of minutes that we have left here, the Office of Children's Mental Health works with youth and adults who have experienced mental illnesses, substance abuse, trauma, or have special needs. They're known as your lived experience partners. What do you hear from them? What do they want to see in the future?
I'd like to share with you what we're hearing from the young people we work with. They're saying that they want more adults and more staff at school to be able to talk with them about mental health. They want there to be more literacy around mental health, and they want people to engage them, actually allow them to have voice in improving what's going on. And so we're excited that we are continuing to work with young people. We have a core of people that we work with who help advise us about these issues, and we're expanding that group. We're also beginning a lived experience academy. So we're going to be offering to people who want to be a lived experience partner with us some training so that they can help in the issues around improving the systems. And those are some of the things that we're doing. And we also have been active with a mental health literacy curriculum that is now available for schools to use that we think will help get this conversation going in some schools where it hasn't been already, and hopefully will give kids the language they need to also talk with these issues about their family and their parents.
Thank you for joining us to learn more about children's mental health. I'd like to thank our guests, Cindy Borgette, a counselor at Alkmaar Middle School, and Linda Hall, director of Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health. I'd also like to give thanks to Brooke Berg, Outreach Program Manager of Family Engagement and Relationships for UW-Madison Division of Extension. We'll have links to youth-focused mental health resources up on our website. Go to WPR.org and the show page for the West Side to find those links. Rick Ryer helped produce today's episode. Kate Spranger is our on-air producer, and she also manages publicity. Coming up next week on the West Side, we're talking about parole and probation reform. Wisconsin has the highest rate of parole supervisions among its neighboring states, and the lengths of parole are nearly twice the national average. We'll hear from local activists and correctional supervisors about how they're taking a second look at those systems. That's next week, Friday, at 10 on this station. Have a great weekend. I'm Claire Neipert, and this is The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio.